Today on the Florida Roundup, the investigation into what caused last week's tragic bridge collapse at Florida International University continues, and students mark a somber return to campus after spring break with vigils and moments of silence. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson is out this week. As the National Transportation Safety Board examines what went wrong, Miami-Dade police launch a criminal probe into the collapse. Also, it's been 6 months since Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Maria. We'll look at how the Florida Keys, Puerto Rico, and the rest of the Caribbean are recovering or not recovering. Plus, the National March for Our Lives is in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, along with marches throughout South Florida and all over the world. That's in response to the mass shooting last month at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. When students return to Stoneman Douglas after spring break, there will be some new rules. The Florida Roundup is next.
This is Mackie Liakis from Port St. Lucie, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup. Now here's Alicia Zuckerman.
Thank you, Mackie. Welcome to the Pledge Edition of the Florida Roundup. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson is out this week. We're starting off today's show talking about the status of the investigation into last week's terrible bridge collapse at the FIU campus. Joining us on the phone is Tony Pipitone, investigative reporter with NBC6. Tony, thanks for coming on the Roundup.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, Tony, first off, tell us, how was it determined in the first place that Southwest 8th Street, where FIU meets the city of Sweetwater, was not safe for pedestrians to cross?
Well, there was a death there in August of last year that, you know, a student was hit by a car there. But long before then, they realized they needed something there. There's about 100 pedestrians an hour on average during the week crossing at that busy intersection. And with the construction in Sweetwater on the north side of where the bridge would have been of more towers, there was expected to be thousands of more students who were going to need it. So it was pretty clear it was needed.
I see. And so what's the status of the National Transportation Safety Board's investigation right now?
Well, they've taken some materials, the tension rods, some concrete samples up to McLean, Virginia, where they have a lab that looks at those things. They've also taken away a large portion of the bridge where it collapsed at the northern end to a facility here, an FDOT facility, where it will be examined. They can't reconstruct the whole bridge. It isn't necessary to do it and would have been difficult to do anyway, but they are focusing clearly on the north end where the deck and a diagonal truss and a vertical support beam net, and that appears to be where a blowout of some kind occurred.
Right. You could see there's a video where you can see just a little bit of a puff of some kind of dust. And I think there's...
And protrusion, yeah.
Right. And the thinking is that was a little bit of the concrete right before the collapse.
Concrete, grout, steel, could have been a number of things, but clearly, you know, something went out of balance. And what we've been able to determine is that when the bridge was constructed on the ground there's certain tensions and compression settings that are made in the various members of the structure. When it's moved and transferred, as it was that Saturday day and Saturday night, a different setting has to be made, and that's where this post-tensioning process comes in. Mm. You know, something is either in tension or compression in a bridge, and the settings depend on the forces on it. So they were changed as it was transported and moved and then put into place. And then once it was put into place, the tension was released on those outer diagonal trusses so that compression took over, because that's the way the bridge was designed. What happened is, after they did that and the road was reopened, because that was done while the road was closed, they noticed the cracking. They noticed something wasn't right, and they called that crew back to do more work, more post-tension work, and what they were doing was adding tension on top of the canopy through a jack on that number 11 truss, that diagonal truss that meets the deck and the vertical pillar at the northern end, and that's when the failure occurred.
Hmm. And so this is, you know, initially right after the collapse happened last week, we heard about this idea of a stress test, that there was stress testing happening. And this post-tensioning that you're talking about, is that's what that refers to. And it was confirmed
that's
this
week. That's a misnomer.
It's a misnomer.
Yeah, it's a misnomer. It was not a stress test at all. Now, there were inspectors there who were watching this work being done. And we're told it was ordered by the chief engineer, who earlier that morning had met with FDOT and FIU representatives as well to discuss the crack and the cracking and how to address it. But this work was being done. It wasn't a test. It was actually being ordered as they tried to address an issue that arose after the bridge was placed.
And that, so that meeting that happened, was that a meeting that was already planned ahead of time, or was that a meeting in response to anything that was, you know, any concerns from that from that very day?
All we know is that one of the items discussed at that meeting was related to the concerns over the cracking, which had been reported 2 days earlier by the chief engineer, Denny Pate, to the Florida Department of Transportation. And people on site were well aware of the problem with the cracking. They just didn't know how serious it was. Now, Mr. Pate assured FDOT that it was not a safety issue. That was his determination based on his analysis, at least on Tuesday. During that meeting, Thursday morning, we don't know what happened in there. But we do know a decision was made or not made to close the road. There was no decision made to close the road. And that obviously was a fatal error.
And it certainly was, and a tragic error. We don't know why that decision was made to keep the road open. Is that right?
We don't, but we do know that accelerated bridge construction, which is what this technology is being highlighted there, and FIU is a national leader in it. One of the big selling points is that you only have to close the road for the positioning of the bridge. Sometimes only one day. In this case, it was about 2 days. So, you know, it's a point of pride for these people that we don't have to close the road. There's a reluctance to close the road, I would think, because, you know, it's not called for. But clearly it was called for in this case, and whether that came into play in that decision-making, I don't know. But it was determined it wasn't a safety issue.
Well, we'll certainly be following that. And in the meantime, Southwest 8th Street, of course, now has been closed since the bridge collapsed last Thursday. Florida Highway Patrol is saying that it could be open at some point this weekend. We've been speaking with Tony Pipitone, investigative reporter with NBC6. Tony, thanks so much for coming on the Florida Roundup.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Thanks. 6 months after two major hurricanes, we look at how recovery is going in the Florida Keys and Puerto Rico. That's still to come. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson's out this week. Stay with us.
Hola, buen día. Hi, good afternoon. This is Earl from South Miami. You're listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Now here's Alicia Zuckerman.
Thank you, Earl. Welcome back to a pledge edition of the Florida Roundup. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson is out this week. It's been a little more than 6 months since Hurricane Irma hit South Florida, and the Florida Keys really got the brunt of that storm. It's also been 6 months this week since Hurricane Maria hit the Caribbean. We're going to talk about how those places are recovering with WLRN's Nancy Klinginer and WLRN's Tim Padgett. Nancy and Tim, thanks so much for coming on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alicia.
Nan, how are the Keys recovering from Hurricane Irma?
I think there are probably 75,000 different answers to that question, which is about the population of Monroe County. You know, for those of us in Key West and probably in Key Largo who didn't really suffer direct traumatic impacts from the storm, life feels pretty normal right now. It's spring break. The town's really busy. There's a lot of traffic. The weather's really nice. For folks in the Lower Keys, in the Middle Keys, maybe in Isla Mirada, where if you lived on the ocean, it's still a daily reality.
And so I know Keys tourism is really something that the tourism board is trying very hard to make sure stays at level or close to the levels, pre-storm levels. How's that going? And why is that such a, you know, why are they trying so hard to make sure people are still coming down while the Keys are in recovery mode?
Well, it's our biggest employer. It's the biggest part of our economy, the biggest single part of our economy. It contributes almost $3 billion a year in a normal year. So we need the money.
Yeah.
You know, the county needs the money.
Follow the money, sure.
Yeah, yeah. And the individual businesses and employees who rely on that need the money. And that's been an impact for a lot of people who, you know, maybe their property, the place they lived, wasn't affected, but maybe they're getting fewer tips at work or fewer shifts on the job.
So there is, I mean, what are they seeing so far in terms of the hit to tourism?
It's the latest collection numbers I saw for the lodging tax, which is, you know, the extra money you spend for a hotel room here. It was down about 18%. And October was down about 23%, which is actually not that bad considering that was right after the storm.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, Key West is responsible for more than half of the tourism economy in the Keys, and Key West probably came out of this storm the easiest. So the problem is you have to take everybody, most people get here by driving, so they're coming through the storm-damaged areas to reach Key West.
And Nan, you visited Big Pine Key this week, and you spoke with some of the people who live there. Tell us, we're going to hear some tape from that. Tell us about Bill Tubbs.
Bill lives on Big Pine Key in a ground level property. It was built in the early 70s, right before the federal government started requiring that you elevate if you were in a flood zone. And his house, it's got a metal roof. It's made out of concrete block. It's got tile floors. It actually did pretty well in the hurricane, but it got about 2 feet of muck in it, which led to mold. So they've had to essentially gut the house. He was initially judged to be over 50% damaged, which would mean you would have to elevate. And then on appeal, finally got that reduced. But it's all led to a really complicated and frustrating wait for him to be able to get the building permits from the county to go ahead and fix.
We're going to hear that some of that frustration right now.
The aftermath for me is actually worse than the hurricane itself. I feel like we're taking a step forward and we get pushed 2 steps back. I think people are, at least in Big Pine, are getting tired of hearing how the Keys have recovered and everything's going great, and it's not for a lot of us.
So, yeah, you can really hear the frustration in his voice there. Nan, how do you think Irma has changed the Keys, you know, from the time that you spend traveling around and talking to people and obviously living there? Can you tell us what some of the long-term effects are?
Well, one effect that kind of happened right away is there's a little bit of an exodus. I mean, I wouldn't say a huge number of people leaving, but and we saw this back in 2004 and 2005, too, especially after Hurricane Wilma. Going through these experiences, some people kind of realize that living in a hurricane zone is not for them, you know, and just dealing with the impacts, the anxiety, the sort of long-term recovery that you heard Bill Tubbs dealing with, you know, it's just not for them. They're out of here. So we have lost people, and that's hard. That's hard on the community as in general and on individuals.
Yeah, the community sort of becomes a more disparate community. Are they trying to move, and this may be very unrealistic to think about, but are they trying to move places together as communities, as neighbors, or is it really just full-on splitting up?
I think it's splitting up and going maybe where you have family, where you have connections, you know, where you can find a job.
Mm. And, you know, the Keys obviously have had, we know the Keys have had a affordable housing issue for a long time. We've done a lot of reporting on that, and the storm made it a lot worse. Actually, I mean, do you think the storm shined more of a light on the affordable housing problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody who didn't know that the Keys had an affordable housing problem. Anybody who comes here and looks for a place to live or thinks about, oh, I'd love to live in the Keys and then looks at what the rents are, knows what the issues are. But yeah, I mean, the storm destroyed a little more than 1,000 homes. It caused major damage to almost 3,000 more. So that's going to exacerbate the already very severe problem we had for sure.
Are there solutions?
I wouldn't say there's a solution in terms of this is going to go away. This is always going to be an expensive place to live. There's very limited supply for a number of reasons, one of which is just there's not that much land, and there's extremely high demand. Since I've lived here, I've seen the conversion of what used to be a house with a bunch of apartments in it into a guest house, or a house in Old Town into a monthly vacation rental. And there's no regulating those. Those, you know, can't be limited by local laws. So we're seeing just that demand pressing onto the limited supply more and more and more.
And there's been some talk, too, about building housing for, you know, city workers, for school workers, for municipal workers, county workers, right? There's something like where there's looking to other places that are able to do that. I don't know how realistic those plans are right now, but I know there's been some talk about trying to do something like that.
Yeah, the school district is already moving forward. I would say the sheriff is very intent on moving forward on providing some housing for his employees near the county's main jail here on Stock Island, there's definitely new urgency to those ideas since the storm.
And we're going to have an in-depth report from you sometime next week on what's happening right now in the Keys and as far as the recovery goes 6 months after Hurricane Irma. We're going to turn now to Hurricane Maria, which was 6 months ago this week. Tim Padgett has been following Hurricane Maria and recovery in the Caribbean and in Puerto Rico closely. Tim, Hurricane Maria knocked out all of the power and most of the cell phone service there on the island after the storm in Puerto Rico in particular. What's the process been like to get that grid back up and running?
Slow and just arduous. It's just hard to imagine three and a half million people on an island having to go through, 6 months now, just to get their lives back to normal, just to have their electricity returned. We've got about 90% of the island now with their power back, but a lot of rural and especially mountainous areas on the island still don't have it back. And it's just hard to wrap our arms around that, really.
6 months of just no power.
Yes, and you're talking about societal paralysis when you're dealing with something like that. I mean, that's all I saw when I was there in October, was that kind of, you know, island-wide paralysis, whether it was electricity or business or transportation, and that's only now starting to ease.
And the official death toll count provided by the Puerto Rican government has been widely disputed by independent investigations and journalists on the island. What are they saying that number was?
They were saying it was around 60, 70, but a lot of particularly investigative journalists there on the island have disputed that because they noticed that the official count was only taking into account, you know, people who may have been very directly killed by the hurricane, you know, somebody washed away or somebody, you know, something fell on them. But what they weren't taking into account was, you know, people who may have died in nursing homes or in hospitals because the electricity went out. So they started snooping around, funeral homes and hospitals and finding out that there were many, many more people indirectly killed by this hurricane. And that number could go up into the hundreds.
In the hundreds.
Yeah.
There's sort of the government deciding we're just not going to look for greater numbers. These numbers are, we want to try to keep the numbers low. I mean, is that kind of intent or just a lack of resources to look?
Lack of resources. I really don't think, you know, it wasn't in the government's interest to keep the death toll low, obviously, because they want the world to see just, you know, how badly devastated this island was. You have to understand how threadbare the island bureaucracy is in terms of taking care of jobs like this. There just wasn't the resources, as you say, to go out and really determine an exact number of people who were killed directly or indirectly by this storm.
And what about FEMA's handling of this crisis, both on the island and here on the mainland, where, you know, a lot of families from Puerto Rico are still living in hotels that are being, you know, paid for by FEMA?
On the island, controversial at best. Some emails were released by Congress this past week showing that in the days and weeks after the storm hit, FEMA was really slow off the ball in terms of getting things like supplies and water and fuel, especially fuel and generators, into the island where they were most needed. There's going to be a lot more controversy coming out of that. Here in Florida, where we've seen the majority of people fleeing the island there has also been concern that they have been wanting, for example, to cut off aid for temporary housing in places like hotels a little too quickly and then transfer that obligation or that responsibility onto the shoulders of the state, which is sort of putting, you know, Florida Governor Rick Scott behind the eight ball, particularly if he does run for Senate. These people are automatic voters when they come to the island because they're U.S. citizens. So if he's going to make a bid for the U.S. Senate, he really needs to accommodate these people.
Do you think that that's been an incentive for people to stay? I mean, I know there are many incentives for people who have come from Puerto Rico to stay here on the mainland. Do you think the right to vote is one of them?
I think that has been, that factor has really been enhanced because you've got a lot of people, for example, who are pro-statehood, a lot of Puerto Ricans who want Puerto Rico to become a state.
And there was that referendum.
Exactly.
How long before the storm?
That was about a few months
before
the storm.
Was
the summer before the storm. And most of the people said that they wanted to become a state. And when they see the dysfunctional way that, that Puerto Rico was treated after the hurricane, I think their feelings, their sense of urgency to make Puerto Rico a state and get better benefits has become even stronger. And so you're going to see them now, I think, voting in ways that they can get the federal government to, A, pay it more attention to this, to the island, and B, eventually make it a state.
Sure. What's the greatest need on the island now, do you think, 6 months after the hurricane? You know, what do people there need the most right now?
Housing is one big issue. You had more than 400,000.
Just like the Keys.
Exactly. You had more than 400,000 homes damaged, many of them just destroyed. And but FEMA first so far has only approved about 40% of the 1 million applications for home repair there. So you're seeing a housing shortage, and most of all, just employment. You're seeing jobs that were just decimated by this storm. They haven't come back, and that's a big reason you're seeing so many people come to the U.S. mainland and particularly to Florida.
So even though 90% of people on the island of Puerto Rico have power back,
right.
The housing, you said, they might still be living in sort of states of disrepair in terms of their housing. So it's just because you have power doesn't mean that, you know, you're back to normal in any way.
And it took so long, for example, for FEMA and the federal government to get simple things like tarps onto those decimated roofs of houses. Once you get tarps onto the house, then you can start rebuilding. But if you don't have the tarps, you can't move back into the house. And that took months.
So that meant it just continued to rain into people's homes.
Sure. You can't really address your housing damage until you get some sort of, you know, roofing on it. And that just took too long.
6 months later now, how does Florida look different because of Hurricane Maria?
Well, demographically, it's going to be obviously more Puerto Rican. I mean, you know, we had more than 1 million Puerto Ricans already in the state, a third of them here in South Florida. And that number is only growing. The numbers go as high as maybe, you know, 250,000 that may have, you know, come to the state. To the mainland, most of those, as I said, settling here in Florida, most in central Florida, but many in South Florida. And I think in South Florida, it's going to be less of a problem for them to settle here, because what you're seeing is a really interesting phenomenon. Most of the Puerto Ricans coming to South Florida are more skilled workers, a little more affluent, people like nurses and paramedics and gynecologists and doctors and engineers, whereas those going to central Florida are less skilled, more working class, and they're having a little more trouble, you know, finding the housing, finding the jobs, finding, you know, the things that they need to get situated.
Is that just because the cost of housing here is more, and that's who can afford to be here? I mean, what is that attributed to?
It's just been a phenomenon of the emigration from Puerto Rico here into Florida.
Over years,
you saw more less skilled workers going to Central Florida, taking jobs, for example, in the tourism industry, the theme park industry. You know, those are less skilled jobs. You saw Puerto Ricans coming to South Florida, taking more skilled jobs, more tech, more medical. And construction.
And last thing, what about the rest of the Caribbean? I know that you did some reporting last week, I think it was last week, on the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Right. The rest of the Caribbean is really having, they're also having, you know, a slow go at it. You know, islands like Dominica that were just, you know, obliterated by the storm, they too are just having so much trouble getting their basic infrastructure up. The U.S. Virgin Islands, for example, still doesn't have a real operating hospital. In the wake of this.
So what do people do? They just have to be flown out or?
Flown out to some of the neighboring islands and things of that nature. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with WLRN's Tim Padgett. Thanks for coming on the Florida Roundup, Tim.
Thank you.
Thousands of people are set to march on Washington tomorrow, and also here in South Florida and all across the country and even in other places around the world, to demand changes in gun policies and to end gun violence. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson is out this week. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Christy Figueres from Miami, Florida. You're listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Now, here's Alicia Zuckerman.
Thank you, Christy. Welcome back to a Pledge edition of the Florida Roundup. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson is out this week. Tomorrow, thousands of people are set to march on Washington and cities across the country and even some across the world to demand a change in U.S. gun laws in hopes to end gun violence in the wake of the mass shooting in Parkland that killed 17 people and also wounded many others. And also, these marches are about many other gun deaths that are happening all around the country. We have with us now Broward County, WLRN Broward County reporter Katie Swatulski. Katie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Alicia.
So here in Broward County, Parkland will be holding its own march. Students of Stoneman Douglas have been the leading voices really around the country right now on what's being called the March for Our Lives. Katie, a lot has happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School this week. Can you break down some of the police activity that's gone on?
Yeah, there have been a couple of security scares, and it started Monday when the brother of the confessed shooter, Nicholas Cruz, his younger brother, Zachary Cruz, was arrested on MSD's campus, and that he was found trespassing, and he was taken into custody. His bail was initially set at $25, but that skyrocketed to $500,000 after he was Baker-acted. So there's that is one element of this, and that worried parents and students absolutely. However, the Broward County, the Broward Sheriff's Office deputy on duty at the time was found sleeping in his car, so he was suspended. And then after that, you know, several other students have been arrested for bringing knives and razor blades onto campus. So the school really had a week of uncertainty, more complaints, and a lot more, you know, being robbed of their peace of mind.
And going back to Zachary Cruz, the confessed shooter, Nicholas Cruz's brother, being Baker-acted, what was the, first explain what that means, and also what was the explanation for why they did that, why the Baker Act was imposed there?
So when he was taken to court, he was Baker-acted, which basically just means against his will, he was being placed in the hospital for a period of psychiatric watch for being considered a concern to himself or others. So the bail, several parents came forward and said, you know, we don't think this bail should be set at $25. That's nothing. And there was that concern from the community of, you know, that he could be let loose again. So I think the court took into consideration the community's deep fears right now, and along with the Baker Act and the fear of Zachary Cruz potentially having access to a firearm, they increased that bail to $500,000.
And where is he now?
He is in the Broward Main Jail, which is the same jail as his brother, Nicholas Cruz. So they are in the same jail right now.
And why do we know why he was trespassing? Was there an explanation as to why he was on the campus? Did he go to school there previously? Was that his school?
He did not.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge. But he was, you know, the explanation we got for him trespassing was he said he was trying to soak in the shooting. I think he thought he was reflecting on what happened. He wanted to be near the school, he told officers, and, you know, that caused them concern.
His lawyer is saying that his constitutional rights are being violated by setting that bond so high at $500,000. Have we heard anything from authorities? Have they said anything yet in response to that, or they're just sort of letting that play out and keeping that number at $500,000?
They're keeping that number at $500,000, and they're going to let this play out because, you know, this is not how normal trespassing is treated. So there are special circumstances to this that don't apply to the average person, but that is what Zachary Cruz's attorneys are saying right now, is it shouldn't be this high.
You'll be in Parkland for the March for Our Lives tomorrow.
Yes.
You've been in Parkland a lot over the last month, and you'll be back tomorrow. What do you know so far about how the city of Parkland is handling the march in terms of logistics and in terms of security?
So there's expected to be between 20 and 30,000 people in Parkland tomorrow. And the city is treating that as, you know, they're acknowledging to residents, look, roads are going to be closed. Garbage pickup is going to be suspended. Please bear with us. This is going to be a huge event. And they granted a special permit for the event to take place. And in terms of security, anybody who's coming to march is not allowed to have any bags on them. Obviously, no weapons or firearms. But, you know, police are saying if you have something, bring it in a clear bag only, and only bring what you need. So maybe bring a little water bottle and some snacks, but don't come with lots of stuff or you'll be stopped.
I want to continue on talking about the march in a moment, but I realize I just want to go back for a second to hear a little bit more about that detail of the BSO, the Broward Sheriff's Office sheriff, who was our officer, rather, who was found sleeping on the campus, sleeping on the job. How did that come to light, and do you know what's happening as a result of that?
Yes, so that deputy is suspended right now. But what happened was when Zachary Cruz earlier this week was found and arrested on Marjory Stoneman Douglas's campus, the deputy on duty at the time was found by students asleep in his car. That was reported by a teacher. Other deputies came and arrested Zachary Cruz. But, you know, that deputy on duty being found asleep did no favors for the community's current, I don't know what you would call it, anger, fear.
Yeah.
They're very
frustration and did probably, I'm sure, a degree of distrust at this point.
At the Parkland City Commission meeting this week, many people got up during public comment to talk about the city potentially trying to get out of its contract with Broward Sheriff's Office.
Wow.
Residents really are, one thing they're considering potentially is partnering with Coral Springs Police. Or going back, they used to have their own department, so they might go back to that as well.
Wow. Do you know when, at what point that split happened? Or I guess it wasn't a split, but they became, you know, they were overseen by the Broward Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, that was several years ago. I'm not sure if it was in 2003 or early 2000s, but it's one thing that citizens have been asking the City Commission more and more to reconsider, especially after this. But it's interesting because now, in response to the sheriff's deputy being found asleep in his car, Florida Governor Rick Scott has come out and said he's placing 8 Florida Highway Patrol troopers at every entrance to Marjory Stoneman Douglas. So he's increasing and beefing up security even more than what it was before.
And that's got to be unusual for a school.
Absolutely.
What else came of that meeting? First of all, what was the purpose of that meeting that you attended earlier? That was Wednesday night?
Yeah. Wednesday night, there was the Parkland City Commission meeting. It was a regular meeting. But during public comment, people got up and they expressed discontent with BSO. They talked about new measures that they're seeing. And it was a chance for the city's mayor and city commissioners to say to the city, here's what we've done since the shooting. Here's where we've been. And here's what's come out of what we're thinking for the future. So they, you know, they asked everyone to please be patient with the march that's going to happen tomorrow. But they also mentioned at the city commission's request, a new police tower has been put up right near Marjory Stoneman Douglas campus. And that's already up. That was put up pretty quickly.
Wow. That's fast.
Yeah.
That strikes me as fast.
Yeah. And that is also unusual for a school to have a police tower right next door.
It's not on the campus. It's next to the campus.
It's next to it.
Okay. Well, spring break starts for the Broward County District this weekend. That's right?
Yes.
And there are going to be some new rules in place when students come back. Those were spelled out by Broward School's Superintendent Robert Runcie at that meeting on Wednesday night. What are some of those rules?
Yes. Students are going to see a lot of changes. It's going to be a new way to get into school. It's going to be similar to an airport style fashion where people with security wands are going to be waving over the students. They don't have permanent metal detectors yet, but students will also have to have clear backpacks. So that's a new requirement.
And 5 of the student activists from Marjory Stoneman Douglas are on the cover of next week's Time magazine, right?
They are.
With one word.
Enough.
That's it. The word enough. Well, we are going to be hearing from the march in Parkland. We're going to be hearing from marches throughout. We'll be hearing some from the march in Washington, D.C., and marches in all 4 of our counties here from Palm Beach down to Key West. But we'll obviously be hearing a lot more from you from that march tomorrow. Best of luck with that. Katie Swatelski, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Tom Hudson will be back in 2 weeks to take us out. Here's a listener.
I am Sandeep Wari from the Magic City, Miami. The traffic is always crazy here, but I don't mind being stuck in it thanks to WLRN and its bundle of amazing shows like the Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. WLRN's engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Myers. The technical supervisor is Jason Zupka. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting WLRN.